We'll turn to the next case this morning, which is 17-3070 Doe versus Hutchinson. You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, we're here today on an appeal that's brought from the District of Kansas in a case involving a lawsuit by a former high school student against the school district and her former teacher. I represent the defendants in the case, the school district, and Mr. Hutchinson, who is the former teacher. This matter was brought as a complaint alleging a variety of causes of action against both defendants. But there's only a single issue on appeal and only a single count on appeal. And so sort of sifting through that, we had filed a motion to dismiss on behalf of the individual defendant against a couple of the federal claims that were asserted against him based upon qualified immunity. Okay. The district court granted qualified immunity on the basis of one of those counts, and that's not on appeal and not before the court. The second qualified immunity argument that we raised, which relates to count 5 of the petition, and that was a count that was brought by plaintiff where she asserted equal protection claims under the Section 1983 for violation of her rights to equal protection based upon her sex or gender. And her allegation was that the acts of Mr. Hutchinson toward her constituted sexual harassment, which formed a cause of action by her under that statute. We had asserted that based upon the allegations that were in the complaint, and because it was filed as a motion to dismiss, the allegations in the complaint, at least those that are factually based as opposed to conclusory, are treated as the law, or as the facts. There's no dispute. We don't get to argue that, well, that's not really what happened, or you know, that's out of context or anything like that. We accept those facts. And in those facts, there were certain allegations about inappropriate conduct by Mr. Hutchinson to include things such as a joke that was inappropriate of sexual or gender bias nature. There were conversations by Mr. Hutchinson with the plaintiff's boyfriend about the sexual relationships between the two of those individuals, both of whom were students of his, and a variety of other allegations that related to things that he did in the classroom or things that he did in the school. There are also conclusory allegations in the complaint, and under the Twombly standard, of course, in the motion to dismiss, you don't have to consider or give weight to those conclusory standards.
The only issue before us, however, is whether the law at issue was clearly established.
That's correct. And I'm getting there very quickly.
No, I understand. I just wanted to make sure. Judge Matheson was on the first case.
There is a single issue in front of you, and that is whether the law was clearly established.
I just want to make sure that you're not arguing other issues that we should be focusing in on.
I am not.
All right.
I am okay. Not.
Sorry about the interruption.
No problem whatsoever. I want to make sure our points are clear. The reason
if that's the only issue, does that mean that you're conceding that the facts alleged in the complaint were sufficient to state a claim for a constitutional violation?
No, it is not. Because if
we're going to clearly established, do you even get to clearly established without having a constitutional violation?
Those are the two prongs of qualified immunity, obviously, and the courts have said that you can take either issue up first before you get there. Our position is there's no case law establishing that the facts as they exist would demonstrate that there is a cause of action based upon those facts for sexual harassment.
Now, I guess my question goes to if the complaint alleges sufficient facts to establish a constitutional violation of equal protection sexual harassment, why wasn't it clearly established in 2014 that a teacher cannot sexually harass a student?
I agree, a teacher can't sexually harass a student. I've never said they couldn't. But
so the answer is it is clearly established.
No, it's not clearly established based upon the particularized facts of the petition, which is why I was going through the Twombly standard and the complaint first.
Well, I understand that. But I take your argument to be that based on cases like Mullenix and White against Polly, where general statements of the law aren't going to suffice,
right,
and where someone in Mr. Hutchinson's position would have had to have fair and clear warning. Why wouldn't it have been apparent to someone in that position, in light of cases like Sterrett and SHA, that his alleged conduct was, in fact, unlawful?
Because the conduct that is alleged against Mr. Hutchinson is not the same type of conduct that was alleged in those other cases.
Why not?
Because it's not.
Well, then give us an argument why it's not. You can't just assert it. Why is it not comparable to the conduct in
those cases? And that's where I was heading.
Then let's do it.
Okay. So, for example, in Sterritt, you had a situation. We cited each one of these cases that were relied on by the district court in our brief. So in Sterritt, you had a situation involving a female employee of a county government who brought a claim of sexual harassment and retaliation. Her male supervisor made repeated sexual advances toward her and other female students, often while intoxicated, with those advances including propositioning plaintiff, requesting that she meet with him at his house and other secluded locations, making obscene gestures toward her and pinching her on the buttocks. And that's Sterritt at 812. None of those types of allegations are remotely in the petition that is filed by the plaintiff in this case. We can all agree that those facts, if alleged, would constitute sexual harassment. And if those facts had been alleged against Mr. Hutchinson, he would have been on notice that that constituted sexual harassment that was actionable under Section 1983.
Yeah, but Sterritt does stand for the proposition that a state actor can violate equal protection based on sexual harassment. Would you agree
yes,
with that?
Absolutely.
And we have a number of cases to hold that.
Absolutely. No. The legal proposition that sexual harassment can constitute a violation of the Equal Protection Clause is a statement of law that I completely agree with, understand. I think the case law is well settled on that point.
Okay.
You're saying
that you have to show, in addition, facts very, very similar to the situation in this case.
Correct. And I think that's what White...
Now, where do you get that from?
I get that from White versus Pauley.
Okay. And do you think that there's any difference in a police shooting situation than a non-police shooting situation? I mean, sexual harassment can be in multiple ways.
Sure.
And if anybody reads the paper today, they ought to know they shouldn't do it.
Sure.
And don't we have enough here on a motion to dismiss to let it go forward, at least through summary judgment?
I don't think as to qualified immunity. I would agree if we'd filed a motion to dismiss on behalf of the school district and said, no, this isn't enough facts to allege a potential or a plausible claim.
So you don't think this constitutes sexual harassment at all, what he had done over the course of several incidents?
I'm not defending that the allegations are appropriate in any way.
No, you saying that there was not any sexual harassment?
I am saying that I don't think the facts as alleged are sufficient to establish sexual harassment as it's been recognized under an equal protection claim. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
Okay?
Well, you're relying on the highly particularized holding in White.
That's correct.
High generalization. The law on sexual harassment, however, is clear, and the only question becomes, as you have noted, whether these facts constitute sexual harassment.
Sufficient.
Is that subject to a reasonable person standard?
Yeah, sufficient to put a person in Mr. Hutchinson's position, a high school teacher, on notice.
With children under the age of 21.
Under the age of 21, to put him on notice that the actions that he's accused of doing are particularized enough, based upon clearly established law, that would put him on notice that he is subject to potential liability under Section 1983 for equal protection violation. I mean, that's the whole issue. And to me...
Why wouldn't SHA at least put him on notice that a teacher on student sexual harassment can be a violation of equal protection?
I think that SHA or other cases would put a teacher on notice that a teacher could be liable for sexually harassing a student.
Well, so we're kind of getting there, aren't we? I mean,
sure.
So you want something that more closely mirrors the situation here. I get that. And so let me ask you this. I'm interested in your view on whether the Title VII cases use the severe or pervasive standard for hostile work environment. Is that the standard that would govern this case here?
I'm not sure, and the reason I qualify that is because I've not found a case that specifically takes that severe and pervasive standard and applies it in a student-teacher relationship in the educational context. Now, there's some Title IX cases that come close.
Yeah.
So I would suggest that we didn't really flesh that issue out at this stage in the case, and it probably will as the case proceeds along.
Well, just one other question about that.
Sure.
If there is a Title VII case
mm-hmm.
involving alleged hostile work environment sexual harassment that is analogous to this case, could that qualify as a case that could be considered for the clearly established law prong of qualified immunity?
I think it potentially could, but none was ever cited by the plaintiff in this case. None was cited by the district court, and I'm not aware of one. So I do think that that's the kind of analogy that could satisfy, because you still have the particularized facts that would be close. And one thing I want to point out about the SA case, and again, this is just to show that the particularized facts of what the defendant in that case is alleged to have done differ from the case in front of the court. In the SHA case, it was an individual where a teacher was accused of physically molesting two students. There's no allegation of physical molestation in this case. This case involves claims that he made inappropriate comments
over a period of time.
Over a period of time. That's fair. Yeah. No, I'm not hiding from what the allegations are. I'm just saying they didn't involve physical molestation, which is what the SA case did involve. And so I think that's what...
Well, the court relied on two cases.
It relied on
Sterrett, and it relied on Tucumcari. You haven't spoken about Tucumcari yet. Why don't you tell us about that case?
Yeah, give me just a second. My apologies. I'm just flipping through my cases real quick. Yeah, Tucumcari is the SA. I thought it was. So Tucumcari, the actual plaintiff in that was SHA. And that case involved a situation where the teacher was alleged of physically molesting two students.
Well, physically molesting is a fairly loaded use of what happened. She touched, apparently, a fifth grader, correct?
I believe that's correct.
And on the back.
Down the pants is what I thought it said. Maybe I've got that wrong. But my recollection was I thought it was back and buttocks. But
well, the court said in addressing the question of whether the law is clearly established in that case, quote, a reasonable teacher would have known in the spring of 1997 that sexual harassment, which gives rise to a violation of equal protection, will also do so in the teacher-on-student context. And that was clearly established at that time. So this is 19...
And again, for that general proposition of law, I completely agree. I think White versus Pauley requires us to look at particularized facts of what the actor is alleged to have done, not the global context of sexual harassment as a label. That's the difference. I would like to reserve my time
alleged,
if I
was
could.
Was the alleged incident of Mr. Hutchinson sitting on... Ms. Doe's fee, couldn't that be considered physically threatening?
I don't believe so. I don't think it remotely compares to the other types of physical allegations that were in play in the other cases. Sitting on somebody's feet in the bleachers during a game, I don't think it's the same. It doesn't have the same sexual overtone that these other situations had in the case law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Dan Curry. I represent Jane Doe.
You can move that microphone up. You would have to bend over. There you go.
Thank you. The three points I'd like to make today is that, one, I believe that Tucumcari does establish particularized facts to show that the law is clearly established. Two, I think that the alleged conduct of Coach Hutchinson is so obviously wrong that even a general proposition of the law would have clearly established the precedent. The third point I want to make is that White v. Pauley, which I believe the entire appeal is based on, the Supreme Court decision, didn't do much to change the analysis of when law is clearly established for qualified immunity purposes. If we look at the SHA v. Tucumcari case, when you look at the facts laid out by the court, there was a mention of an allegation of abuse. But the actual facts of the case, and that's what we're looking for here, is particularized facts, is that there was no sexual abuse. It actually states the genitals weren't touched, the buttocks were not touched. It talked about a teacher who was touching the back, the thighs, different, you know, basically in these students' massages. And the court at that point, maybe a decade ago, said, hey, this is so clearly wrong. The case law has been clear for a long time that this is a reasonable teacher in this fellow's shoes. The reasonable shoes test should know better.
So Tucumcari is your best case?
I think it is the best case. Now, it's not the only case. There's other cases, too, because the Tenth Circuit is...
What's really your second best case, then?
My second best case, I think, is Johnson v. Martin.
Okay.
Johnson v. Martin, again, they say, you know, sexual harassment is clearly established. And in that case, there were many plaintiffs and many victims of a municipal employee who was requesting a lot of sexual favors from a variety of applicants. And while some of those victims did have physical contact with this gentleman, some of them didn't. Some of them was purely verbal, sexualized conversation.
Does it make any difference that the verbalized conversation in this case was directed to the boyfriend as opposed to the student? I'm sure he went back and told her what the coach said.
I want to preface my response with when we originally put together this lawsuit, there was a count targeting the invasion of privacy, and the district court judge said, I think that does make a difference that it was Coach Hutchinson asking the boyfriend about it in the wrestling room and not asking the girl about it. But in the terms of the sexual harassment, I think it makes it worse. I mean, arguably, because he's questioning this high school boy, hey, describe for me and this whole audience of wrestlers what sexual acts this girl's willing to perform. I mean, if that was in an employment setting, boy, that's easily a sexual harassment, hostile environment.
Would it make any difference if she never knew about it?
She did know about it.
Well, no, would it make any difference if she didn't?
Oh, if she didn't know about it?
He just kept it to himself and didn't say anything to her about it.
I don't think it makes a legal difference. I think there's background evidence here. You know, I think the law is pretty clear that if you have a tortfeasor who is creating an atmosphere of harassment, harassing other people too, that is evidence that I could put forward to say, here, this is a hostile environment. So I do think that we've got particularized facts here, if we need them. The next point I want to bring up, though, is that I think that the acts as alleged...
I thought there were also direct comments made to the woman student.
There were, yeah. I think there was...
Well, just the way you answered the question.
Oh, sure.
Judge Kelly sounded like it was relying purely on the communication with the boyfriend and not with the student.
No, Your Honor. I think we have a whole variety of different... stripes of evidence.
Right. We don't have to go into those.
Okay. All right.
I agree with Judge Lucero, but just on that particular point, apart from the statement in the gym class, can we tell from the complaint, that's what we're dealing with here, can we tell from the complaint how many times he made a sexual comment in her presence? Can we glean that from the complaint? Have we got more than just the boyfriend and the gym class?
Right. Yes, you can. Because in the complaint, it is alleged that he continued to make inquiries about the about her sexual activities, and it also says, as alleged in the complaint, that he continued to make sexual comments about and including Jane Doe going on into the future after that December 2014 series of events. So we did not provide examples, you know, of the future comments, but we did allege that it kept happening.
Well, you also say in your brief that Mr. Hutchison engaged in inappropriate conduct, and the quote is, for many years. This is on page 10, but may a court consider the defendant's conduct during the time even before the plaintiff arrived at the school?
I think it can, because what the case law says, what is a sexual hostile educational environment? What it says is you've got to consider the context, right? And this is the school, going to school at Smith Center, and the context is that you've got a coach who everybody knows had an inappropriate relationship with a kid. And also, everybody knows that for years, he's been making these sexual comments about students to students, year after year after year. And that's the context when Jane Doe transfers into that school district in 2013. That's the hand that she was dealt there. So I think that if you look at the context, you look at the power dynamics there, which is a factor to consider under the case law, it helps to show that this was not just being perceived or experienced as a joke here or a joke there. If that answers your question. I guess, you know, the...
Well, actually, it doesn't completely. I just haven't seen any authority to that effect in situations where you are... It seems like the theory is this hostile environment. Where a court could consider as relevant evidence conduct that occurred preceding the plaintiff's presence at the institution, whether it's employment or school or anything else.
I guess the best authority I can give you right now is the Supreme Court's Davis v. Monroe County case, where it said that actionable sexual harassment depends on a constellation of sundry circumstances, expectations, and relationships. And so what I'm arguing is that this history 5 years prior that was ongoing is some of those circumstances, expectations, and relationships that have to be considered. Then I could also point to the Jennings v. University of North Carolina Fourth Circuit case that goes into a bunch of factors to look at when deciding whether or not there was a hostile educational environment going on. One of those being a general atmosphere of hostility toward a particular gender. And I would argue that having a 6 or 7 year history leading up to the events that are at issue in the case is evidence of a general, ongoing, protracted atmosphere of hostility.
It goes to sort of the mens rea?
Well, it goes to that, too.
I mean, I don't think you'd get it into evidence as a 404B going back that far, would you? And what would it be proving? Intent or motive? Or?
Sometimes...
That's an evidentiary issue. Is it?
I guess I would argue, when you look at Title VII law, Title VII law, you're trying to prove an animus, and you can point to things outside the mind to help establish the animus. And to that extent that analysis applies here in the 1983 action, which I think it does, it is evidence that... Now, I argue that going 6 years back, it gets more attenuated, right, the further back in time you go. But here we have really an interlocking chain of ongoing harassment at that school. The third point I would like to bring out, I don't know if I really articulated my second point, but the second point is sometimes a person does something that's so blatantly wrong that you can point to a general proposition of the law and say, hey, this is so wrong that he was on notice, even if the law is not really particularized. And I think the law is very particularized.
Well, what's your best case for point two?
My best same cases that are, if you take the defendant's...
Well, do you have a case that says, even though there isn't another case that's factually on point, the conduct here was so egregious that we don't need a case that's factually on point? Have we ever said
sure.
that?
Yes, you have. And I'll first start with White v. Pauley itself, which White v. Pauley, when it is cited, to say you need to have particularized facts. You can't just quote a generalized law. However, White v. Pauley also says that sometimes when the action is so wrong, you still can use generalized law. So the Supreme Court said that. Subsequent to White v. Pauley, the Tenth Circuit on several occasions has also said that. And the one we cite in our brief, which I think is the best expression of that, it is an unpublished decision, but it is Apopasa v. Ramish that came out in 2017.
That's in your brief.
That's in the brief. And in that case, I think that's a very useful case for two reasons. One, this is the quote that I wrote down from it, but the precedent may be adequately particularized even if facts differ, for general precedents may clearly establish the law when the defendant's conduct is obviously violative of the law. And that's actually, I have to say, it's a paraphrase. I got some of those words wrong, but that's close. The other thing that's useful about that case, the Ramish case, is that it's the only one I could find that takes a stab at defining what does the Supreme Court mean by particularized facts. And that Supreme Court said you need particularized facts in most cases, but what does that mean? You know, how is that different than anything the Tenth Circuit, the test that's been applied for the last few decades? I can't see right now how it really changes things. What the Ramish case said is we should look at it as, is there a material difference in the fact pattern presented? And that's why I think I can stand here and tell you guys, your honors,
well,
that...
it seems to me that just argues a degree of harassment that is just not necessary under the law. The law speaks about sexual harassment, as counsel so frankly argued. And the question is whether he should have been on notice that this particular conduct fell within that ambit of definition. That seems to me to be the question.
I would agree that's a perfectly logical way to express it. You know, I'm trying to make sense of White v. Pauley. And when I look at it, I actually see two variables. I see one variable being how clear is the law, how particularized is the law, and I see another variable, the y-axis, which is how obviously wrong is the fellow's conduct. Because that's the only way you can square the Supreme Court's statement that you need particularized conduct unless...
to evaluate.
Right. Unless it's so obviously wrong that generalized precedent will do. That's what the Supreme Court said. So sometimes you don't need particularized facts if the conduct is so obviously wrong. That's why I'm saying there's an obviously wrong angle here that we could argue to say, it's a fallback argument for us. Our frontline argument is, Chukwukari is close enough. Doesn't have to be the same facts. Tenth Circuit said that post White v. Pauley, has repeated that over and over. Doesn't have to be the same facts. Doesn't have to be on point. Even White v. Pauley says doesn't have to be on point. So Chukwukari is close enough. And there's no much. I see my time is up.
Thank you.
Please, Court. Just two very quick points. In the two cases that they say are their best cases, in the SHA case versus Chukwukari, or I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, the allegation is that the teacher put his hands down the inside of the boy's shirts rubbed their chests and backs, put his hands under their shorts, rubbed their legs from the mid-thigh almost up to the point where their legs joined their bodies. In the Johnson case, the other one they say is their second best case, the official was alleged to have used his position to make sexual comments, engaged in unwelcome touching of a sexual nature, attempted forcible sex, requested sexual favors. Those are not the facts of this case at all, either one. And Judge Lucerno, you simplified our argument quite succinctly. Our position is that under Pauley, White versus Pauley, it's not enough to use the generalized proposition of law and say sexual harassment is well established. You have to have particularized facts that equate to the facts alleged in the complaint to survive qualified immunity. That doesn't mean that there might still not be a cause of action against the school district or the employer if it's an employment case, but for purposes of qualified immunity, you have to have clearly established law that's particularized to the facts that are alleged against the defendant. And the way the quote from White versus Pauley reads, clearly established law should not be defined at a high level of generality.
Well, so we need a law that, or cases that say if a gym coach does it,
no.
As opposed to whether a math teacher does it.
No, I think that's cutting too fine of a point. I mean, I would concede that. I think the types of behaviors that he engaged in, though, have to be the types of behaviors that have been recognized by other courts. And what you have here,
that's correct what you quoted from White, but White also said the general statements of the law are not inherently incapable of giving fair and clear warning to officers where the unlawfulness of the conduct is apparent.
Right.
Why doesn't that support the plaintiff here?
Well, White versus Pauley also says clearly established law must be particularized to the facts of the case. Otherwise, plaintiff would be able to convert the rule of qualified immunity into a rule of virtually unqualified liability simply by alleging a violation of an extremely abstract right. And my position and our argument is sexual harassment is an abstract right. It's a term of generality. It's a conclusory term. It wouldn't survive Twombly standards if you just said he's sexually harassed. You have to have particularized facts, both to survive summary or to motion dismiss based on Twombly and also federal
standards. But you would agree there are some competing formulations of what constitutes clearly established law, and one of them is what puts the reasonable person in the defendant's position on notice.
I do agree with that, but I think what White versus Pauley suggests is that that has to be something that is particularized enough factually to the allegations against the defendant in the case at issue. And if you don't have particularized facts, if the facts aren't similar or similar enough.
Your point is understood, and I've allowed you some extra time, so I hope you won't hold that against me too harshly.
No.
The case is submitted, counsel are excused, and we're going to be in recess for about 10 minutes. We'll be.
Thank you very much, Harold.